Hi, it's Patricia Carvalis here. I'm the host of the Politics Now podcast, and I spend a lot of time talking to politicians, usually grilling them. But over summer, I want to introduce you to the people behind the politics. What will Tim Wilson never compromise on? What's the worst criticism Josh Burns has ever received? And did Larissa Waters realise she was changing history when she fed her screaming baby in the chamber? You can find the interview series in the Politics Now podcast feed.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, why is Australia getting on the front foot over former Prince Andrew?
I've written to Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and I've engaged with him to confirm that my government would agree to any proposal to remove him from the line of royal succession.
The Prime Minister says he wants to be the first in the Commonwealth to back ditching Andrew from the royal line of succession after his arrest last week. We're going to find out just how involved Australia really is in this process. Then, the opposition wants to criminalise helping repatriate Australians with links to terror organisations or hotspots. You'll hear a response from a key charity.
This was the first policy the new opposition leader put out. I think it's a thought bubble that's unworkable in practice. And if the pathway to the lodge is really paved off the back of some of the world's most vulnerable children, innocent Australian children, then I've got real concerns about what that says about political leadership in this country.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, it's been another big day of Epstein news. Firstly, with another arrest over in the UK. Lord Peter Mandelson is the former British ambassador to the United States. He's been arrested by police in London on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Feels like deja vu, because that is the same reason that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was arrested at the end of last week. Lord Mandelson is a former government minister. He was fired from his ambassadorship late last year, and police launched a criminal investigation into him after the government passed on communications between Mandelson and Epstein. They were following up on allegations that he passed market-sensitive, potentially market-shifting information to Epstein back in 2009 when he was the UK's business secretary. Now, a reminder that both him and Andrew deny any wrongdoing. But on today's wrap, as this story breaks out of the UK, we're going to focus on the arrest of Andrew and the conversation following that arrest around removing him from the royal line of succession. He's eighth in line to the throne, and the British government said this morning that it is open to changing that.
Before I conclude, I understand there's been a high level of public interest in the news of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's arrest last Thursday and what may follow. The government is clear that we are not ruling out action in respect of the line of succession at this stage, and we will consider whether any further steps are required in due course.
It is vital, however. Keir Starmer's Chief Secretary Darren Jones addressing the House of Commons there. So, why is this conversation picking up steam now? Well, because the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, announced overnight that he had sent a letter to his British counterpart saying that Australia supported removing Andrew from the royal waitlist. Here's what he told the ABC's AM program this morning.
Australia likes being first, and we have made sure that everyone knows what our position is. I think Australians want to know that the Australian government regards these allegations and regards Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor as being not appropriate.
Interesting comments. Well, our political correspondent, Tom Crowley, shared his analysis about what the Prime Minister had to say.
The Prime Minister says Australians like to be first, maybe a reference to the Winter Olympics there. It hasn't always been the government's approach to foreign policy, though. Take Donald Trump's border peace as just one example. We're still waiting for Australia's answer on that one. It watched the lead of its allies there. This time, though, Anthony Albanese's made the judgment that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor should not remain in his place in the line of succession and says he wants to send that message proactively on behalf of Australians. Perhaps unlikely to be a contentious move. The coalition figures we've heard from this morning sound supportive, and Australia has to pass legislation at federal and state level, so we do have a formal role here. It's all a lot of ado for someone who's eighth in the royal batting order, but that's the procedure that sits behind these things.
I think many of us will be stealing that line from Tom Crowley, the royal batting order. Well, let's look into the official role that Australia actually plays in this process. University of Sydney Professor Emerita Anne Toomey is a constitutional law expert, and she came on with this explanation.
We've now got our own rules separate from the United Kingdom, so they've become part of our law, and the United Kingdom, if it enacts its law, can't change us. We would do it ourselves. Last time this happened was when they wanted to change the rule of succession so that males didn't get preference over females and you didn't get knocked out if you married a Catholic. There was an agreement to do that in 2011. The British enacted their law in 2013. And it took till 2015 till we finished the process. And that's because the process is that we need each Australian state to enact a law, to request the Commonwealth to enact a law. So we need seven parliaments to enact legislation, basically.
And so is there a streamlining here, or can Australia and the UK be out of sync with this process?
Well, that's the issue. I mean, you know, theoretically Australia could unilaterally act if it wanted to, but from a political point of view, they don't want to splinter the crown by having different members of the royal family turning up as monarchs in different places if you change the rules. But in Australia, we've also got one other little problem, and that is covering clause two of our constitution, which is a provision that says that references to the Queen in the constitution extend to her heirs and successors in the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. So if our rules of succession got out of sync with the United Kingdom's rules of succession, then there's an issue about what covering clause two means. Is it just an interpretation provision, or is it substantive? Do we have to have exactly the same person who's king of or queen of the United Kingdom? It's never been litigated. We've had no reason to find out. Probably best avoided. So probably Australia would want to keep exactly the same rules as the United Kingdom has.
So hypothetically, for whatever reason, if the UK government didn't go ahead, could we still go ahead?
We could, from a legal point of view, go ahead and change our rules of succession. It's fully within Australia's power now. But because of that constitutional reason and the very tiny sort of risk that somehow this would get our rules out of kilter with the United Kingdom, probably we wouldn't bother doing it. The realistic, you know, thing is that he's eighth in line to the throne. The chances of him becoming king in the United Kingdom or Australia are just so low. You wouldn't ordinarily bother with this kind of legislation. Really, the point of it is a political and symbolism thing.
Constitutional law expert Anne Toomey there. Well, with this story developing as we came to air, we wanted to put it to a member of government. Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy had already planned on speaking to us from London. He's there to observe AUKUS submarine production sites. But this was Sally's first question to him.
Why is Australia offering support for the possible removal of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor from the royal line of succession?
Australians are rightly disgusted about the revelations in the Epstein files, and I think Australians are right to hold the view that it's entirely appropriate that Andrew is removed from the line of succession. So when the UK government signalled that they were open to that possibility, Prime Minister Albanese was absolutely correct to signal that we would support such a move.
Moving to defence, you're in the UK to visit several key sites to observe progress in the delivery of the AUKUS submarine program. Have you been satisfied with what you've seen so far?
So far. The AUKUS program, which is nation building for our country, creating 20,000 high-skilled jobs and giving the Navy the best submarines in the world, is hitting every milestone. And so far, what I've seen in the UK confirms that. Today I announced that we've invested $310 million in some long lead items for the first two reactors, for our first two AUKUS submarines that will be built in Adelaide. So this is another tangible example of progress being made on AUKUS.
What does this mean for the timeline of delivery and operation?
It's consistent with it. We've hit every major milestone, so we're on track to cut steel by the end of the decade and for the first AUKUS submarine to be delivered in the early 2040s. Prime Minister Albanese, with the South Australian Premier and myself and Mark Butler, made the announcement of $30 billion to build the submarine construction yard at Port Osborne, Port Adelaide rather, and that will be the first submarine construction yard in the Southern Hemisphere capable of building nuclear-powered submarines. And this is an important milestone in giving the Navy the best possible equipment to deter conflict in our region.
The new opposition defence spokesperson, Senator James Patterson, says the federal government is cannibalising current Defence Force capabilities to pay for the AUKUS submarine plan. Are other parts of the ADF losing out to this project?
Absolutely not. He's demonstrating a gross ignorance of his portfolio, and he should do less time talking and more time reading. We're increasing the defence budget. We've increased it by $70 billion over the decade, which is the largest peacetime increase in the defence budget. Far from taking money from other areas, we're spending $21 billion to establish a missile manufacturing industry in our country. We'll have three missile factories built. One's already built. The second one will be online by 2027 when they produced only two media releases. We've got ghost sharks in the water already. We're acquiring 11 Megami-class general-purpose frigates. We're building capability in every domain. And Senator Patterson's comments were incredible. They were incredibly ignorant. He talked about needing more missiles. Well, we're building missiles and we're getting more strike. He said we needed more drones. Well, we've got the first armed drone in the country, in the country's history, when his government cancelled the only armed drone project at the time.
Minister, yesterday we heard from the Ukrainian ambassador to Australia, 4 years on now from the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion. You've agreed to work with the UK on testing long-range weapons for Ukraine's military campaign. What's the progress?
Well, we've announced that as part of the Australia-United Kingdom defence industry dialogue I had today with my counterpart. And this is about making our facilities available for the UK, which has been a very strong supporter of Ukraine's valiant resistance to a Russian aggression, to test long-range weapons that they are looking at giving to Ukraine. Well, we've got a number of ranges. I don't want to be too specific because we've got to be conscious about operational security.
And just finally, on another matter, international media is reporting that the US military is preparing to strike Iran as early as this weekend as it ramps up its presence in the Middle East. Last year, the Australian government gave its support to US strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. Would we do so again?
We do stand with the brave people of Iran in their struggle against oppression, and we demonstrate our solidarity to the Australian-Iranian community. But I'm not going to go into details of any conversations we may or may not have had.
And that is Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast about some of the areas of his portfolio, but also that news that the Prime Minister is backing ditching Andrew from the royal line of succession. Well, let's turn to another political story. The pressure on the federal government to block the return of 34 Australians in Syria with links to the Islamic State terrorist group. The opposition has proposed a new criminal offence to punish those who assist in the repatriation of Australians with links to terror organisations or hotspots. On the programme yesterday, we actually asked the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister, Ted O'Brien, if that would include aid groups like Save the Children. Here's what he had to say.
To the extent that they are assisting foreign fighters, families or sympathisers of terrorists, yes, it would. To the extent that they are providing humanitarian services, no, it would not.
And that is the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister, Ted O'Brien, speaking to Radio National Breakfast yesterday. So this morning we wanted to hear from Save the Children. We invited on its CEO, Matt Tinkler, who responded to those comments.
Oh, look, I think it's a worry for Australia. I'm not concerned for our organisation. I have supreme confidence that the things we've done over 7 years of sustained effort on this issue have been above board and in line with our humanitarian principles and values. But I am worried about the message this sends to Australia as a country. I mean, this was the first policy the new opposition leader put out. I think it's a thought bubble that's unworkable in practice. And if the pathway to the lodge is really paved off the back of some of the world's most vulnerable children, innocent Australian children, then I've got real concerns about what that says about political leadership in this country.
In what way?
No one here has come up with a plan to deal with the real issues here. So we have known for 7 years that these women and children have been stranded there. The women have never been charged with a crime, convicted of a crime. The children, by definition, are innocent. They are Australian citizens with access to Australian passports. Australia has an obligation to deal with this. The national security advice consistently that I've received over the years in briefings from departments and officials has been the safest way to deal with this cohort of women is to bring them home to Australia and let Australia's national security and judicial systems apply. There's no prospect that they'll face justice in Syria. They need to come home, Sally, and no one has a plan to deal with that. And I just think that's supremely disappointing.
Are you concerned that the work that you and your colleagues do could be criminalised under the opposition's proposal?
Well, we've done two things over 7 years of work on this issue. Number one, my colleagues in Syria, these are people who've lived through more than a decade of war, have dedicated their lives to providing humanitarian relief to these women and children in the camps. They are an inspiration, these staff, and when I visited the camps, I was truly inspired by the work they're doing. The second thing we've done is advocate for the Australian government to take responsibility for its citizens. We are not engaged in any extraction operation or repatriation effort. That's not within our mandate, and we won't do those things. So I'm not concerned that we will fall foul of these proposed laws. I don't think there's any prospect that laws will be legislated. The opposition's a long way from forming government, and the government has already ruled it out. But as I said, I think the broader signal this sends is a real concern for us.
Is there anger amongst your staff, many of whom work in very difficult and dangerous situations around the world?
Look, our organisation was founded 107 years ago by a woman who famously went behind enemy lines at the end of World War I and campaigned to feed the so-called enemy's children. These were children starving behind the Allied blockade in Germany. And since then, we've grown to become the world's largest child rights organisation. That woman virtually invented child rights, and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is now the most ratified treaty on earth. And what is really disappointing to us is that no one seems to care about the rights of these children. No one seems to be taking into account their best interests in decision-making here. And from my perspective here in Australia, as an Australian citizen, I find that deeply disappointing.
Can you understand the fears and concerns of some Australians about this cohort returning home?
Oh, totally, Sally. I'm a parent and I would never make the choice that some of these women made. But the Home Affairs Minister made a really important point on Sunday on ABC when he said, we can't treat these women all the same way. Some of them may have made a choice to go, and that was deliberate and that was wrong, and they should be punished have the law applied for those choices. But that's not going to happen in Syria. Some of the women were coerced or forced to go by partners or fathers, and some of the women were children themselves when they went. So their story is not homogenous, and we can't pretend they are. But the main point here is, to the extent that any risk exists that these women may pose now or in the future, that risk is not going to be mitigated by leaving them, you know, to the fate of whatever happens to these camps in the coming weeks in northeast Syria. The best way to mitigate that risk is to have faith in our judicial system, our law enforcement system, our national security system. These women have volunteered to be subject to very onerous terrorism control orders where every aspect of their lives could be monitored if that's what it takes to get their kids home.
Matt Tinkler there, the CEO of Save the Children. We're going to finish up in Mexico because you may have seen news of the killing of a major cartel boss by security forces. His name was El Mencho. He was one of the world's most wanted drug traffickers. Following his death, there has been this huge wave of cartel violence. At least 25 Mexican National Guard Force members have been killed. Cars have been torched, there are highways blocked by gunmen. So we called up Latin America correspondent John Bonfilio, who's based in Mexico, to explain just what's going on and who El Mencho was.
Well, I mean, he came from nowhere to some extent. There is a sort of a mythical element to him because although he's one of the older, last remaining members of the older generation of cartel bosses. Nothing has been seen of him. The only photographs we have of him are as a youth when he got arrested in the US on a couple of occasions. But in 2009, his path led him to establishing the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, where over a very few short years, a really small span by comparison to other notable cartels, such as the Sinaloa Cartel, he managed to increase the size, the scale, the reach, and the power of this group to the point at which it is now, with or without him, the most powerful criminal group in Mexico and arguably internationally across all areas.
What's been the reaction from cartel members and others to his killing?
Highly violent, highly present. There has been a significant show of strength, not just in Jalisco, in the western state of Jalisco, where El Mencho and his cartel had their sort of home base, but right across the country. We've seen violent responses and attack on state forces in at least 20 of Mexico's 32 states. 2,500 troops have now been sent to that region. We've had a casualty list. We've had at least 25 federal officers killed, and people across the country are, streets are unusually quiet. People are trying to stay at home, wondering what comes next and making a real attempt not to get caught up in whatever developments are due down the line.
And we've seen some nations warning their nationals who may be travelling in Mexico also to exercise caution. We've seen some scenes of violence unfolding even at airports, John.
Yes, there are a number of nations that are issuing instructions to shelter in place in certain parts of Mexico, to follow local government instructions, and some to sort of restrict travel to Mexico. It is worth remembering that Mexico is a very big country with an excess of 120 million in population, but notwithstanding, we have not seen a sort of a quasi-national criminal response like this in a long, long time.
What do you make of it, this response, John?
I mean, it's expected. It's whenever anything like this happens, whenever there is a what's generally known as a decapitation strike, by which the authorities try and take out the head of a cartel or a criminal group, then the first stage in the response is mayhem, is an attempt to sort of push back, to demonstrate the strength that these groups have. And then this generally sort of evolves into an ongoing wave of violence as the splinters within the group then vie for control and power of what remains of the organization. So that's expected. What wasn't expected was what took place on Sunday. Nobody here at all thought that something like that was possible, that it was on the cards, given how counterproductive it is to Mexico's interests, and the fact that the president, Claudia Sheinbaum herself, is one of the most vocal critics, usually, of this so-called kingpin decapitation strategy. So the question on the streets of Mexico at the moment is, if she's so against it, why did she issue the instructions on Sunday morning?
And that is Latin America correspondent John Bonfilio there, speaking to Sally on Radio National Breakfast. Well, thank you very much for listening to today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Every interview you heard was presented by Sally, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Michael Commode. If you want to hear more interviews like that, you can. On ABC Radio National, live at 6 in the morning, and then later on in the day, you can catch The Breakfast Wrap on ABC Listen and ABC Radio National. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you tomorrow.